This is Fresh Air. Woody Allen fans, and there are many of them, like to look for a piece of themselves in his movies. Allen's comedies are anxiety-ridden, obsessive, full of self-doubts. His serious movies pose moral questions and ponder the meaning of our lives. So we think we know him. But for all his fame, Woody Allen shuns the publicity that usually goes along with it. Eric Lax is a journalist who met Allen 20 years ago and spent the last four working on Allen's biography. It's not authorized in the sense that Allen asked him to do it, but it is an admiring cooperative effort between Lax and Allen with help from Allen's associates and friends. Woody Allen is known for withholding information. Actors working on his films are only given their pages to learn, nothing else. I asked Lax if he thought Allen kept anything from him.
No, and here's why. I think that even if he wanted to, over a period of 20 years off and on, and for the last 4 years very intensively of talking, and where I've had the opportunity to interview more than 100 people who he's worked with and grown up with, where I've seen him for hours on end and interviewed him for countless hours on end, that no matter what he wanted to hide, it's pretty hard to hide that once I become privy to so much information. So that I don't think there's any way that he could dictate, you know, what I would know and what I wouldn't know.
It's interesting to me that he is a recluse, a private man in one of the world's most populous cities. I mean, it seems to me that if you want privacy, move to Wyoming. Don't live in New York City.
But if you're in New York City, you're one among so many, and in Wyoming, you're an easy target.
Is that his philosophy? I know he's smitten with New York.
But. Yes, I think his philosophy is that if you're not in New York, what's the point of being alive? That there is something about the city that captivated him from an early age. He first went to the city with his father when he was 5 or 6, and he says, you know, when I came up out of the subway and I looked around in Times Square and there was a movie theater here, and 20 feet later there was another movie theater, and there were papaya stands and guys with suitcases and apparently stringless dolls dancing on them. He says it was just a wonder to me. And he played hooky from school one day, and he went to a theater. It was the first time he'd gone to a movie in New York, and Duke Ellington and his orchestra came up out of the pit, you know, playing Take the A-Train. He says it just blew the top of my mind off. It started a love affair with the city that, you know, you see, of course, most affectionately in the film Manhattan. But in all of Woody Allen's films, New York is this glimmering, soaring place that's, you know, filled with cosmopolitan people. And he says, of course, that's not the New York that really exists. He says it's a portion of it, but New York is dirty and it's decaying and it's filled with the homeless. He said, but my feeling about it has never changed from my first impressions as a child. He says, I know it's a terrible place in many ways now. He says, but I'm like a child whose father is a bank robber or an alcoholic. You love them in spite of their failings.
Do you think he came from a traumatic or even dysfunctional family, or had a traumatic childhood?
He certainly had a traumatic childhood. His parents were simply unable to get along. They were kind of gunpowder and a match over anything. They each took the opposite side. His mother was very penurious. His father was very spendthrift. Yet there was they obviously loved each other. They've been married and have been married for 60 some years now. But for Woody, it was traumatic in that he was subjected to the arguments on a constant basis. And one of the things about him now is that he just simply doesn't lose his temper. He just has an inability to do it. He says the idea of losing your temper in front of your kids would just be so awful to do.
Well, he even seems to imply that it was his parents bickering and fighting that robbed him of a temper.
Yes, I think that's the implication of there, is that I think he saw it as being destructive, and that it obviously frightened him. He said there were days that I'd go to school and not know that I would have two parents when I came home that night.
Well, instead of getting mad, what does he do?
He got even. This is the title of his first book. He learned early on that you can buy your way out of difficult situations with a laugh. He has, on top of sort of a funny gene in his elbow or his knee or wherever the funny gene is, that he just has this natural talent for humor, is that he learned that humor was really a wonderful way to make a difficult situation better. And he exploited that early in his life. He was very amusing among his friends and those close to him, although he never really spoke to strangers. So there were really two Allen Koenigsbergs, as he was then known. He was not voted the most funny guy at Midwood High School, because not very many people knew him. But what was amazing is that he came in second, because among the few people who knew him, they realized that he was this very funny kid. So that he's been able to transport that into a wide variety of successes for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Lax. He's the author of a new biography of Woody Allen. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Lax is my guest, and we're talking about his new biography of Woody Allen. You have some very painful descriptions of his attempts at stand-up comedy, and this went on for a long time. The terror as he would wait in the wings to go out, and the kind of non-reaction from the audience.
Yes, you know, when he would first go on, he was just so terrified. He literally had to be pushed onto the stage sometimes. And curiously enough, that when people did respond well to him, he would put his hands over his ears to shut out the applause. And I asked him about this. I said, you know, I said, here's this old story about you putting your hands over your ears. I said, you know, why would you do this? And he said, you know, it's obviously some deep-seated psychological thing. He said, all I can suggest is that as a child, I so wanted approbation and approval. I so wanted people to love me in one way or another that once they began to applaud or to ask for my autograph, I was so embarrassed by the kind of venality of my wish that I wanted to run away from it again. But as he started out as a performer early on, he would get in, and he was performing in groups of 8 or 10 people at a time, 2 or 3 shows a night is the hardest kind of group to work. But he had to learn the timing and learn how to relate to the audience. He had, before he started to perform, a certain kind of wise guy, sort of hostile attitude. He had to abandon that once he started to perform. He realized, after his manager Jack Rollins told him about it, one night Woody was complaining after a show, saying, you know, that they don't get it, basically saying, you know, they don't know what's funny. And Rollins said, you know, you have to let them like you. You have to let them into you. He said, once they like you, they'll laugh at you. And so he had to go from being this kind of wise guy, snooty sort of fellow, to somebody who people could understand and who people could like.
He credits Danny Simon for turning his professional career around. And I guess in terms of building a joke or a funny story, how to build it on the straight line.
Yes, that was to this day, he says that there are 4 people he thinks are the most crucial to his career. And one of them is Danny Simon, who is Neil Simon's older brother, and who the two of them wrote together for some time, both Danny and Neil, and then later Danny and Woody. And Woody was about 19 when Simon took him under his wing and taught him that the most important thing about a joke is not the punchline, but the straight line. If you have a great straight line, then you will have a great punchline. You will have you may have what you think is the best punchline in the world, and if you have a rotten straight line going into it, the joke will just not fly as well.
His other influences include 2 people that I consider to be both ends of the movie spectrum. One of them, Ingmar Bergman, and the other one, Bob Hope. Where do you see their influences?
Bob Hope. If you look at Woody Allen's movies when he's doing, especially if you look at in Sleeper, and I'll give you an example in a second, he does, from time to time, Bob Hope to a T. Bob Hope had these conversational lines that were delivered in kind of a meringue-like way. Hope was the coward's coward. He was vain. He was a womanizer, and yet in the end, he had all this pluck and bravado that would come through. In Sleepers, there's this scene where Woody and Diane Keaton are dressed as doctors. They're from an underground movement, and they're going to kidnap what's left of the leader, the great authoritarian Big Brother figure who is running the world at that time. And all that's left of the leader now is his nose, from which they're going to clone a new leader. And there they are in the hospital, and they're going down the hall, and Woody has Keaton by the hand, and he's biting her fingernails, and he's saying, "Don't be worried, don't be worried." Meanwhile, he's shooing away on that. And then they get to the guard at the door, and Woody's kind of, you know, fills himself up a little bit in this perfect Hope way, where he just kind of puts the arm out and says, taps the guard on the chest and says, we're here to see the nose. I understand it's running.
Oh, God.
Hope did that all the time. Hope is the kind of guy who can stand around, you know, with Arnold Palmer saying he's one of my best pupils. and Hope was, at about 7 years old, was just a gigantic influence on Woody. He was watching The Road to Morocco, and there were Hope and Crosby riding a camel and singing, you know, like Webster's Dictionary, "We're Morocco Bound." And he saw these guys with this fantastic verbal interplay between themselves, and he said, gosh, this is what I want to be.
Now, Ingmar Bergman, I think, epitomizes the dark, brooding interior.
Bergman's for the big questions. You know, Bergman, when he was 17 or 18, he and some friends heard there was a picture with some nudity in it. The picture with the nudity, and it turned out to be Summer with Monica. And, of course, it was a must-see picture. You know, he was 17 years old, so off they went to see it. And, you know, the nudity was there, but he said, gee, you know, that was nice, but the movie was really terrific. And here was a kid who was not particularly learned, did not take school at all seriously, and found something in these films that resonated in him. His argument all the time now is people accuse Woody of saying, of dwelling only on these, you know, the big questions. You know, why is life worth living? Is there a God? And his argument is that whether he treats them comically or seriously, he says those are the only questions worth answering, and asking rather. And when people say, well, you know, what he as yeah, we sat up all night as college sophomores talking about this. But now we've gone on to other things. His argument would be, you know, you've matured a lot since you were a college sophomore, and maybe it's time to start asking those questions again.
How would you describe his directing style? And actors have not necessarily complained about it, but have been puzzled by his lack of direction.
Yes, he's very subtle in the way he does it. He calls himself more a corrector than a director, but that's not entirely true. There are two huge themes of his life that came early on to him and that run through all his movies. One is music, which is he fell in love with jazz at an early age, and we'll come back to this perhaps in a second. And he scores all of his own movies. But the other thing that really matters and what reflects in his directing is the influence of magic. When he was 11 years old, he became entranced by magic and loved the notion of misdirection and sleight of hand, that you draw the attention one place and then pull off the effect somewhere else. That same misdirection is what he applies to the way he deals with actors. He wants them to come in and to be thrown off enough so that that whatever plan they have for their interpretation of what this character is, he tries to set it up so that they're kind of forced to deliver their lines conversationally, as Bob Hope did, that they come in and the spontaneity of the voice comes through. It can be frustrating if you're an actor who's used to an entire script to come and work on a Woody Allen film, and if you only have one scene or two scenes, you'll only get the sides for the scenes that you're in. You'll never know, sort of what part of the bomb you're making.
Does he have a favorite of his own movies?
His favorite at the moment, I suspect, is Purple Rose of Cairo. It has an ending which is really the reason that he made it, which is that you have to accept reality over fantasy every time. That's what makes life run. There is a lot of his childhood in there, of the kid who went to the movies and tried to escape. It's a wonderful sort of notion, you know, it's a story within a story of, you know, a woman is sitting in a theater and a character, she goes again and again and again to see the film, and the character in the movie suddenly looks out and says, you know, this is the fourth time I've seen you today, and you're a very interesting looking woman. It comes out and the movie comes to a start because the other actors in the movie, the movie comes to a stop because the other actors can't go on without him to deliver the lines. And it's this wonderful kind of fantasy, and you think, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if life were like that? But yet this character comes out of the movie, and they go to a restaurant or a bar, and he tries to buy her something, and he pulls the money out of his pocket, and of course it's play money. And the currency of the movies, he's saying, is worthless in reality. And in the end, that's what we're stuck with.
I want to get back to something you said earlier. It's an image of him clapping his hands over his ears as people were applauding his stand-up comedy. Is he suspicious of success? And I'm thinking he has had some successful movies, and successful meaning popular. They made some money, and popular and critical successes. And yet that seems to put him into some kind of a tailspin when something like that happens.
In a number of ways. One, the reason that he doesn't take except Oscars when he's given, or any other awards that come along, is he says as gratifying as it could be to have them, that if you accept the verdict of people when they say you're good, that means that you have to accept the verdict of people when they say you're bad. And he says you can only be responsible for yourself for what you believe is good and bad. One of the reasons I think that he's been able to make 20 movies of the high caliber that he's done, and will make another 20 or so, I'm sure, before he's done, is that he's never stopped to rest on success or rest on his laurels. The moment someone's come around and said, hey, this is great, he said, we can't go on that assumption. Let's go on and try to make it better. And I think that sort of notion of staying hungry and not listening to the good news is what keeps him going. When he sits and shows the rough cuts of his films to the dozen or so people whom he trusts in New York, he's not interested in people saying, gee, this is really wonderful. What he wants to hear as critically as possible is what doesn't work and why. It doesn't mean that he'll then say, oh, yes, and then go off and change it. Sometimes he'll say people make these criticisms and, you know, it's nice that they make it, but they're absolutely wrong. But sometimes they'll catch something, he'll say, yes, that's right. And it's the negative stuff that he wants to hear.
So he's not a snob.
No, and as he says, there are critics who attack me all the time, and he says, you know, the truth is, I'm in many ways closer to their feeling about me than I am about the people who praise me so much of the time. And it's not meant as a slight to those people, but it's a sense of saying, you know, I know that I still haven't made the perfect movie. It's, again, his compulsion here. And he wants very, very much to make movies that will really stand the test of time, that will be like Grand Illusion, as one he points out, or The Bicycle Thief. And he says, I've made, 20 movies. Many of them are quite good. But I don't have those little shining points of light that in a director's career really, really make them shine, that really raise them to the highest level. And he says, I hope that now that I'm in my 50s and I'm a father and I see life a little differently, that maybe now I'll be capable of doing that.
Well, thank you, Eric Lax, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. This is a great pleasure.
Eric Lax's book is about Woody Allen, and it's called Woody Allen. This is Fresh Air.